Okay, the first question. I am not going to wait for you to sit down. I'm going to start. What is body scanning and how does it help with mindfulness? A body scanning is learning how to be aware of the feelings in your body. For those people who have difficulties with stopping thinking, you start with a part of the body, and I usually, I know many people start, they want to do the body scanning from the head of the head downwards. I prefer the other way. It's okay, leave it here. I prefer the other way, starting from the toes and then moving upwards. So you're aware of the toes, feelings, kindness, mindfulness and kindness. Don't forget the kindness, so you relax your toes. Move into the feet. Aware of any feelings in the feet, relaxing them. Ankles, feeling, relaxing them. Moving all the way up the body. The reason I do it that way, because by the time you get to your abdomen, where there's a lot of organs which really need to be relaxed and healed, you've got mindfulness, you've got kindness built up, and then you can start really getting your whole body very, very healthy. So you do that, and I have many stories. I had food poisoning 2 or 3 years ago. It's occupational hazard for a monk because we don't know what you put in the curries. And I had cramps. Ah! Ooh! You know what it's like if you have real food poisoning? Too lazy to go and see a doctor. So mindfulness, kindness, and just relaxing my whole tummy. 20 minutes later, food poisoning totally gone. There's no feelings of any indigestion or anything. And that was cramps, real food poisoning, 20 minutes, all gone. Much better than medication. That's what scanning does to you. Become aware of your body. But not just awareness, the kindness and everything relaxes. And the other thing with body scanning, anyone who has insomnia, can't sleep at night, do body scanning. Start with your toes. Kindness, remember. Relax your toes, relax your feet, relax your legs, because a lot of insomnia is because your body is so tense with the stress of the day and you can't go to sleep because it actually is painful. Maybe you don't notice it because it doesn't change that much. It's just been there for hours. You relax the body, and usually by the time before you get to your bottom, you're fast asleep. Learning how to relax. How does the impersonal disattachment express love? That is the core of our very own humanity. Look, I'm pretty selfless. Do I have kindness? Am I a compassionate monk? Was the Buddha a compassionate guy? You bet he was, more compassionate than anything else. When you let go of the sense of self, you get more compassionate, not less. It's just nature. The problem is you get in the way of compassion. So you get out of the way, and all that's left is compassion. The core of our very own humanity, this is actually, is compassion and wisdom. You are the problem, not the solution. So you disappear, and then lovely things happen. It's true. Okay, look, to make it very clear, because I'm going through this very quickly, I'm not messing around. I'm going to make my confession today. My confession is, because sometimes people say, you wrote all these books here. Ajahn Brahm, can you do jhanas? I can't get jhanas. I can't do it. I can't meditate. I'm honest. I can't meditate. I can't get jhanas. I, Ajahn Brahm, has to vanish first. Bye-bye, Ajahn Brahm. Bye-bye, this doer. Bye-bye, this controller. When I vanish, then these things happen. This is what happens. As long as you are there, you can't get jhana anything. I vanish, bye-bye me, and this is what happens next. Peace, stillness, bliss, compassion, jhanas, everything happens when you disappear. That's why letting go, what are you really letting go of? Yourself. Taking care of another person inevitably brings concerns, feelings, compassion, and attachment arises. Naturally, no. It happens unnaturally, attachments. Real compassion, the greatest act of love is to let someone go. The greatest act of love is to let yourself be who you are, stupid, crazy, restless, whatever you are. The greatest act of love is not judging you, not trying to change you, not curing you, but caring for you. That's what compassion is. And it's an incredible thing. You know, you get someone who's, say, a prisoner in jail because of a paedophile. I care for you. Don't try and change. I love you for who you are. If you say, what? Are you allowing paedophilia to continue? This is just psychology. I say, I care for you. As you are, I don't want you to change. I'm not going to punish you. And then the paedophilia vanishes, disappears. It's the kindness, the acceptance. The reason why people do bad things is because they don't like themselves. They have no love towards themselves. If you have really big compassion towards this body and mind, you can't do any bad things at all. You can't hurt anyone because you're not hurting yourself. So, just compassion does not naturally lead to attachment. How to come in terms with these two, love, compassion, and non-attachment. Whew. Compassion is non-attachment. My father said, I said this last night, the door to my heart, son, is open to you, no matter what you ever do in your life. Not going to try and make me to be a great person, what he wanted, but he'd love me anyway. That was the love which let me go. And that was one of the reasons, you know, I became who I am. Non-attachment is love. How does one deal with living alone without a partner and content, but others always ask and judge, causing anxiety? Other people are stupid. Why on earth do you follow what they say? So if you want to be by yourself, enjoy it. Well, because these days, it's a great time to live. You can be by yourself as a woman and you have no pressure on you. It's allowed. It's your right. You know, we have rights and allowances in our modern society. In the time gone by, they would think there's something wrong with you. If you're a woman, you're alone, you're a lesbian. There's nothing wrong with being a lesbian. If you want to be a lesbian, fine. A monk, I went to the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras breakfast because I was supporting the gays in Australia. And when I gave a talk to the gay and lesbians in Western Australia at their breakfast, I said, you think that you are strange. I'm more deviant than a lot of you. I'm not straight, I am not gay, I am celibate. In our modern world, that is weird. Because even people think that. They think, in places like Australia, United States, you're a monk, yeah, I know, you have some sex on the side. Because they look at Catholic priests. Catholic priests are celibate and they get up to a lot of sort of bad stuff. And they think celibacy is unnatural. And that's exactly what they said about gays 10, 20 years ago. Being gay is unnatural. We can have a clinic and cure you. That is offensive. And now those same people which fought for the rights of the gays now criticize as unnatural celibacy. So the next time there is going to be a gay and Mardi Gras anywhere in the world, I'm going to get a float. Celibate rights. I demand my right to have no sex and be happy. That's exactly. If you're single, enjoy it. You've got a lot of benefits being single. Look, all of you have been married for a long time. Don't you agree with me? Great being single. I've got no one to nag me. I've got no one to go and tell me what to do. That was brilliant. So, all of you, if you want to have a happy life, just come and be a monk. Come and be a nun. Great stuff. None of husbands are pain in the butt. But the thing is, don't follow what other people say. It's crazy when you believe other people's criticism. Look at me dressed like this. Now, for the last 40 years, in the West, and people say, you're dressed like a girl, you're sick. I'm not going to listen to what they say. So, don't follow what other people say. That's why you have two ears. One to go in, one to go out. When I meditate, most of the time my body feels very hot and sweaty. Why do I experience such? Because they've got too much temperature in here. Turn on the aircon. No, there's two reasons. I said this to someone just in the interview a few moments ago. Two reasons for heat during meditation. One, in the beginning, your metabolism hasn't adjusted to the fact you're doing nothing. Now, you've been going up and down there, talking like anything, like it's in a market in this temple. If you really want to go, this is only a one-day little retreat, so if you really want to do a big retreat, please shut up. Because every time you talk, you are disturbing your mind and disturbing the mind of others. That's why we have silence. How can you be silent in your mind after you've just had a talk, a chat with somebody just a few moments ago? You're wasting the opportunity to meditate when you go talk, talk, talk. And is it really useful stuff you've been talking about a few moments ago? It's a lot of rubbish, isn't it? Not useful at all. So learn how to be silent more in life. Great rivers flow silently, said the Buddha. The small streams make all the noise. Okay, so what are you? So, and that's the first thing, is that when you become start meditating, your metabolism is used to coming and going, talking, thinking, and now it stops. And it takes a while for your body to adjust to the fact you don't need so much energy. So the blood is pumping, you're metabolizing things, too much energy, so it just gets dissipated in heat in the body. And that's heat when you start meditating. Later on in meditation, this is a great important point, you may get heat in your body when you start to get very peaceful. Especially if it's in parts of your body, you get hot spots. That is exciting, because that is healing happening. You know, you get hot spots, and I tell this to women, because I don't know what it is in Canada, but there's a quite significant proportion of women get breast cancers. And what is it, 20%, 30% or something? It's scary. You know, what is the percentage? But it's, you know, it's somewhere in that area. So that's, you know, one in three of you, one in four of you sitting here, you're going to go through that terrible thing. So sometimes you learn how to meditate, and then you're sitting here, still, you've got to do it properly, get very peaceful and still and happy, and you get a hot spot in your breast. Brilliant. It's wonderful. You are stopping an incipient tumor from arising. This is the natural healing processes of your body. When you get out of the way, again, you're the problem, controlling, doing this and doing that, you stop the body healing itself. When you really let go and you're very peaceful, you get a hot spot, and afterwards you feel so relaxed, so wonderful, tensions have vanished. One of the greatest successes in healing, which happened in one of my retreats, a guy came to one of my retreats wearing a rubber face mask. And I thought he was some weirdo, just sadomasochism or something. I didn't know. What are you coming to my retreat for? And if you want sort of sadomasochism, maybe go to a Vipassana retreat where you have to hurt yourself and sit all day. That's a bit cheeky, but there we go. But he was wearing the rubber face mask because he had psoriasis over the whole surface of his body. And he said, I've got to wear this face mask to stop myself scratching my skin off. And he opened up his shirt, and it's disgusting to see this rash all over his body. He lifted up his trousers. He didn't go all the way, just went up to his thighs, and he saw this rash everywhere. And he said, I've been to psychologists, specialists, consultants. No one has been able to help me. I've come on your retreat as a last throw of the dice. And he said, I don't know if I can last a couple of hours meditating, let alone 9 days, because this is irritating all the time. It's torture. And Think about it. If you go to these underground dungeons and torture places in our world, yeah, they hurt you for a few hours, but at least they let you go. This is 24 hours this poor guy had to suffer. I just felt so much compassion, sympathy, when he saw disgusting, just this rash all over him. And I was so proud of him. He lasted for 9 days. And at the end, he came to report. He never came to report during the retreat, just at the very end. He opened up his shirt with a big smile. No face mask. Psoriasis had disappeared. Except he lifted up his trousers, a very small band over his ankles, maybe about 2 inches wide. And a big smile, he said, "You know, many people will be very concerned about this. This is nothing, nothing at all, compared to what I came in with. Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. You've rescued me from torture." Or the meditation had. That's what this thing does. It heals. As long as you stop controlling. You let things be. You relax. So if you get hot spots in the body during meditation, during that stage when you're pretty peaceful, reasonably still, great. Your body's healing itself. That's how it works. How to differentiate between kind to your body during meditation without being indulgent. You know, it's the negativity of Westerners think they're indulgent. They just, you don't know how to pamper yourself. You take some extra chocolate and you feel guilty afterwards. The guilt is worse than the indulgence. It's the negativity which kills you, not the chocolate. Isn't that wonderful teaching? Yeah. Some people say that I'm fat. I already told you the other day, it's not fatness, it's a big heart pushing out my tummy. But today somebody gave me some fish and chips. "That's bad for you, Ajahn Brahm. Too much cholesterol, too much oil, too much this, too much that." You'll agree with me, all the doctors here, they sent me this article. When you are happy, when you smile, when you laugh, your blood vessels expand. They get bigger. Which allows the cholesterol and other gunk to go through without jamming. But if you get angry, miserable, guilty, your blood vessels, they contract. That's a fact. So even small amounts of cholesterol, you know, just by, you know, just having a tiny bit of oil on your bread or on your lettuce or whatever else it is, a small amount clogs up and you get heart attacks, strokes. So for your cardiac health, for your longevity, forget about, you know, your weight, but look after your happiness. Stop being miserable. Stop being guilty. And then a little bit of happiness, indulging happiness. Smile a lot, laugh a lot. That answered one of the questions which were always bothering me when I was a young man. Why are fat people always happy? My teacher, Ajahn Chah, was fat. And I don't know, those of you of my generation, there was a TV show I used to watch, but it was called Robin Hood. Those of you who know Robin Hood, one of the characters in Robin Hood was Friar Tuck. He was fat and happy and good. So he was my model, what I wanted to aspire for. Have you ever seen a monk, oh, you're okay, who was thin and mean? Have you ever noticed that? No, he's laughing. He's fat and happy. But the fat and miserable ones, if you are, who's that another fat and happy person? Santa! Santa Claus! Isn't he lovable? Kids love Santa Claus. They love Friar Tuck. They love fat monks. Especially if they're happy. Because the fat, miserable ones, too much cholesterol, miserable, very thin art, thin blood vessels, double whammy, they have been wiped out by Darwinian evolution a long time ago. Only the fat, happy ones are left. The fat, miserable ones have died. The thin, miserable ones have died. So if you are overweight, be happy about it. Then you'll survive. So this is the thing about indulgence. Please, you don't live by bread alone. You don't die by bad food alone. Happiness, joy is really important. So at least, you know, learn how to indulge and be happy. Please, could you please teach us how to be kind to my body in order to move forward? It's really strange. But, you know, I always thought that people knew how to be kind. Don't. The story I told last time I was here, said it very quickly to someone who was saying anxiety. If you have anxiety, you can feel it somewhere in your body. It's usually around here somewhere. So when you notice where the anxiety is, take a hand and caress it. Really do it nice. Ah, there you go. Oh, thank you. It feels really good. You know, as a monk, you're not allowed to have a girlfriend or a wife. No one else can do this, so I do it for myself. You feel, oh, yeah, I like that. And this part of my body is already really relaxed because you've rubbed it, massaged it with kindness. It really relaxes. And when the physical manifestation of anxiety disappears, so does the anxiety. In my book, I told a story about this lady from Adelaide. And I've told that story for such a long time now, most people know it. But it's in the book if you haven't got the book yet. And one of the doctors in Perth, she's a Bangladeshi doctor, she was treating one of her patients in the hospital with severe anxiety. She had to be on oxygen all the time. Because of anxiety, she couldn't breathe properly. You know, to have an oxygen mask on. And she had tried all of the usual medications. You have like a list. Try this one first of all. If that doesn't work, then try something else. If that doesn't work, try something else. She'd gone through the list. No more medications left, because nothing had worked. And she was about to finish work for the afternoon. What can I do with this patient? Nothing has worked. So she remembered Ajahn Brahm's powerful technique of kindness. Now, I don't know if she should have done that because, you know, it hasn't been approved by the National Health Service or anything. But what the hell, she decided to teach her patient, next time you have an anxiety disorder, find out where it is in your body. And then take your own hand and massage it with kindness, mindfulness and kindness. Massage it until the whole feeling vanishes. And then you'll probably find the anxiety vanishes. So she told her that and went home to her husband and her kid, went to work the following morning, and she was so surprised to see that patient with the oxygen mask off, breathing normally, anxiety gone, and she said, can I go home now? It's cured. And I say, you should have tried Ajahn Brahm's method from the beginning, instead of all these chemicals. It works, and this is a true story. The next time you have anxiety, find out where it's in your body. Next time you have anger, how does that feel in your body? It's a place in the body where anger manifests. Take your hand and just massage it. Oh, there you go. That's really nice. It actually feels nice. And then you find the anger goes. When the feeling goes, the corresponding physical feeling to that emotion goes, and so does the emotion. And that way, you've got a great method of being able to let go of any emotion you want, by noticing its physical manifestation, being kind to it, relaxing it, and then it disappears. So you know, it's really powerful. You know, sometimes we get all these seminars about, you know, mindfulness and medicine, and you get all the best teachings from monks. We're way ahead of the game. You hear it here in the West End Meditation Center before you see it on the TV. My body sometimes will start to move and maybe end up leaning forward with head touching the floor. Please wear a motorcycle helmet so you don't injure yourself, because this temple cannot afford insurance. It is very relaxing, but it is still considered meditation as long as you're letting go, yes. I'll be quite aware of the body sensation still. Yeah, it's just, this is what the body needs to do. I don't know why. Once when I was teaching meditation retreat, I saw this woman and her body was twisted in such contortions. This is only about a third of how she was twisted. If I did this, you'd have to take me to the hospital straight away. And I was so concerned. Actually, another meditator said, look, this woman's in trouble. Look how she's contorted. And I was really concerned about her. So after the meditation, I took her aside and said, are you all right? And she said, I feel wonderful. I was just learning about meditation. And because I haven't had much injuries, so I didn't know what was going on. And I said, do you realize that you are just contorted? You know, really in amazing. I've never seen anyone like that. It would kill most people. I said, no, I never realized that. I was just very peaceful and very happy, and I feel wonderful now. And then, of course, it clicked. I realized, oh, okay, I know what's happened. And I asked, when did you have your accident? Car accident. Amazing, Ajahn. You really do have psychic powers. I haven't told you that. I was involved in a very serious crash in hospital for many weeks. Many things broken and injured. I didn't need to read that in her mind, because I know that when your body gets injured, that sometimes you can't get healing, because you do need to get into a difficult position so the body can push its energies up to where it's needed. And when she was letting go, she wasn't there. She didn't know what the body was doing. It disappeared. Her body had moved by itself to allow the energy to go back to heal all these wounds inside her body. And afterwards, after the body had done its thing, it straightened up. And she felt wonderful. So sometimes if your body wants to do weird things, let it. It knows much better than you how to heal itself, how to look after itself. So if it wants to twist, let it twist. If it wants to move forward or back, let it. That body is knowing what is necessary to heal. And you know that works, because afterwards you feel so good, so relaxed. Amazing. Ajahn Brahm, do you have a ghost writer? You write a lot of books. Oh, I thought you wrote a lot of ghost books. For a busy monk like you. Now, a lot of times you have these stories, and what I do is I just write them down as I would say them. And when I write down, like, the art of disappearing, not the art of disappearing, was it? Don't worry, be grumpy. I wrote all of that down. No one else wrote that. But it's so easy when you're not always criticizing yourself. Is this right? Is this wrong? I can do better. Don't try and be a perfectionist. Let things flow. And if you do things like that, it flows very quickly. You get high quality stuff done in a very short time. Efficiency. I'm a very efficient monk. I do a lot of work without getting stressed. And that's how you do it. Just let it go. Stop having this thing inside of you saying, was this right? Was this the right story to say? I shouldn't have done this. Maybe I should do it differently. Maybe I should apologize. For, I think about 3 or 4 times I said the word bastard in this since I've been in Toronto. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. I said it again. That's 5 times. I do not censor myself. I haven't got this person over me saying, bad Ajahn Brahm. That means it just flows. When life flows like that, you find you get a lot of work done very quickly, and it's usually high quality. Based on your own personal experience, how's Ajahn Chah like? He's like no one else. Is attaining jhana a must-have to remove the fetter of Sakaya Ditta and get stream entry? In Anguttara 4, okay, this is another thing. To get stream entry, I would say yes. That's a controversial point. But as far as my experience is concerned, I don't see how anyone can actually see the Dharma without getting a jhana. You can't know what water is unless you leave the water. You can't understand what your will is, your body is, unless you leave it. So that's why I say jhana is necessary. But they say in Anguttara 4, Ananda explained the four ways to attain arahatship. Arahatship, remember, not sotapanna. You've got insight preceded by samatha, samatha preceded by insight, samatha and insight together. And they say, and then you develop the path, the Eightfold Path. And lastly, see by agitation and steadfast mind and see the path. That fourth one is a thing which is not very well described. The first three are easy. You know, calm and then insight, insight and then calm, calm and insight together. Remember, did I do this today? Samatha and insight?
No.
Okay, this is Ajahn Chah's Samatha and Insight. Samatha Vipassana simile. Now you see the front of my hand. The back of my hand is there. It's just you can't see it, but it's right behind, I promise you. Now, as you see the back of my hand, you can't see the front of my hand, but the front of my hand is there. Now you see the front and the back together, just about. That is samatha preceding insight, the front preceding the back, but the back is always there. That is the back preceding the front, that's insight preceding samatha. That's the two of them together. You can't have one without the other, basically. The fourth one, okay, the fourth one is actually you get inspired, basically, by a great Dhamma teaching, and that insight gives you this beautiful energy that it frees the mind from the hindrances, and then you can see the path. Inspiration, but the inspiration leads to the peace and stillness of the jhanas. That's actually the fourth one. We won't go into detail over there. Bhante Gunawata, Bhante G. Sri Lankamang, in his autobiography, stated that he doesn't have a problem with the woman thing. That's not very nice, is it? Are you a thing, or are you a woman? Do you have a problem with the woman thing? If you don't, please disregard this. Too late. Now, I've got to be careful there because some people try and trick me. Even in Sri Lanka, on the TV, they just confronted me. Okay, Ajahn Bhante, all this talk, you know, you're really well known now. Are you an arahat? On TV. They put me on the spot. So what should I say? So I told them, if you can tell me, sir, what is the arahat? Whether it's my body, whether it's my feeling, whether it's my perception, whether it's my mental formations, thought, will, or my consciousness, and which of the six consciousnesses is that is an arahat, then I can answer you. That was my answer. Listen. When you say, are you an arahat, have you this? It's all about self and attainments again. You're missing the point. The whole point of this path is for you to disappear. You're not anything. And the more you're not, the more these labels sort of actually apply, but they don't really apply. You're disappearing. You're not in this thing for attainments. Have you ever noticed in the Sangha of monks or nuns, we don't actually wear stars. You don't get a medal for first jhana. Okay, this is first jhana. Yes, it's been approved. I can wear my first jhana medal. And then my second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana medals. The immaterial jhanas, you don't have medals because it's immaterial. They're invisible medals. And then, you know, four sotapanna, one stripe. Two stripes for one's returner, three stripes for what's it called, the anagama, non-returner, and you get a cap. This is a different path. It's not worldly stuff. It's not attainments. It's disappearing. If you are an arahat, there's no place to put the cap on. There's no place to put a medal. It's like trying to write in the air. There's no place where it sticks. So that's what an arahat is all about. So the women thing, please disregard this. You're not a thing. You're talking about lust. Do you have lust? What is lust, anyway? So lust is another form of stupidity. But some few years ago, okay, can I? Hey, I've got time to do this. I haven't really. I've started already. A few years ago, there was many monks in Thailand, even in my tradition, were caught misbehaving. And they had mistresses. And so I decided one Friday night to make my own confession. You've got to be honest as a monk. Without honesty, what's the point? So I took a deep breath and said in front of all my disciples that some years previously I had some of the most wonderful moments in my life, some of the happiest moments in my life, in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we hugged. There was another man's wife. That was my mum. My mum is another man's wife. My father. And I mention that because how often do we judge people? We rush to a conclusion. We haven't got all the evidence. You think that people thought like that. A few people went for the door. They weren't going to come back again, ever. It's adultery. Kissing another man's wife. When I explained it to my mother, they burst out laughing like you did. Anyway. Are having odd sensations normal during meditation, feeling like you're out of your body? Will you continue to load your talks on YouTube? They're not my talks. And we don't have YouTube anymore, we have no self-tube. There is no you anymore. So we have Anita-tube. Can we start Anita-tube? Instead of YouTube and MeTube. Anyway, that's only a joke. Sensations, odd sensation, normal during meditation? Of course they are. Everything is normal. So, if you feel like you're out of the body, you're not out of the body. It just, perception starts to, I call it perception growing its wings, start to do abnormal things. First time that happened to me, I was actually a couple of times when I was a young monk, but one was really strange because I was just walking in the forest and I went past the washing area in this forest monastery and I saw a towel hanging on the line, perfectly black, dark black. And I stopped and I thought, this is weird. You see blue towels, yellow towels, pink towels, white towels, but never seen a black towel ever in my life before. If any of you want to start a new line of fashionable bathroom additive, or try black towels. They're very good because they don't need washing so often. And you can't find a black towel, you know, in any shop, I'm sure, in Toronto. Can you? Oh, someone got my idea. But I'd never seen one before. And so I stopped and stared for about almost 5 minutes, a long time. And as I was staring, after 5 minutes, it turned black to white again. And for 1 second, it was black. Well, for 5 minutes, it was black, and then it turned to white. It was a white towel. I thought, am I going crazy? Am I going mad? It's not. It's just the way your perception is so conditioned, is trained to only see things in one particular way. That's called education. And, okay, it's true, you know that. And in meditation, all those constraints are taken off and you can start to see things in weird ways. Ways which shouldn't be real, but they are. Just perception is becoming wide, growing its wings. And that's why there's a certain stage in meditation you start perceiving really strange things. Your body lifting off, sinking to the ground, expanding, expanding, expanding. That's the other excuse that I used in a retreat in Singapore recently. I said I was in one of these states and my body was expanding and expanding and somebody's phone rang off, so I came out of meditation and my body got stuck like this. I got all sorts of excuses for being fat. But anyway, you do get those feelings in meditation, weird stuff, flying through the air or whatever, and sometimes rocking or whatever. And people say afterwards, you are perfectly still. You weren't flying through the air, you weren't rocking, you weren't expanding. Or Ajahn Chah exploding. That's, you know, just nature of the perception. And once it's had its little game, it settles down, you get very peaceful afterwards. And I tell people, please enjoy that. Meditation can be so boring sometimes. When you get weird stuff happening, great. It's like seeing a movie. You're not allowed to watch movies as a monk, but this is a free one. Yeah, what's going to happen next? Weird stuff. And I love weird stuff. It's perfectly safe. It settles down after a while, and the perception just behaves. It's just like you Sri Lankan parents, your children go to a university a long way away from where you're living. Yeah, mum and dad are out of the way now. I'm going to party. So your kids go wild when they leave home the first time, just for a couple of weeks, and then they settle down again. It'll be normal. This is like perception. When you are not controlling it anymore, it goes a bit wild, just like a teenager when they leave home for the first time, but then it settles down again. That's all it is. We are stuck on anatta. You can't be stuck on anatta, you're stuck on atta. Can you please explain? Anatta, there's nothing there. How on earth can you be stuck on nothing? How can you get sort of like one of these post-its and just stick it? You need something to stick it on. But there's no one there, and there's nothing to be stuck. The anatta, but what they're really saying is they can't really comprehend it. Look, you will not be able to comprehend it, and much of the stuff which I've said, you will not be able to understand at all. You think sometimes I'm crazy, because I thought Ajahn Chah was crazy. I'm sure many people thought the Buddha was mad, because they couldn't comprehend it yet. But later on, you do more meditation. More and more and more meditation, you get very closer to understanding what the Buddha was talking about. At first you just can't. But nevertheless, meditation is good for the health, it's good for the body, and these teachings are good fun and they help you in your life, they solve so many problems, so you keep on going, 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 going. And then one day you get into a really deep meditation, your little tadpoles go out of the lake, things disappear. And my God, the Buddha was right. Jesus, this is amazing. One of the things which happens to you, you think, especially Sri Lankans, you've got faith in the Buddha. You don't. If you become a stream winner, I mean really a stream winner, your faith in the Buddha just goes through the roof. And the respect you have for that guy who could see that, and the way he taught, incredibly perfect. That man could describe it so beautifully. I mean, you can only have to experience it, first of all. I've never been to Paris. You can read guidebooks, people tell you about what Paris is like, but that's not the same as actually going there, smelling it, hearing it, feeling it. That's what happens when you get to any deep stages of meditation or insight. When you feel it, and you go back and look at the description, the guidebook, written by the Buddha, your faith and estimation of the Buddha goes through the roof. That was one hell of a teacher. You know, he certainly knew his stuff. Anyway, what is the difference between Mahayana and Theravada Buddhism? Just the spelling. Okay. As Buddha said, intention is karma. If mercy killing considered, what does right intention supersede killing? In mercy killing, who are you being merciful to? A lot of time what we say is mercy killing is putting that sick person out of my misery, not out of their misery. You don't like to see them suffering. So that's why you see it's sort of like an animal hit by a car or something. Oh, I've got to put that animal out of its misery. It's not the animal's misery. You are just getting rid of it. It's your misery in seeing somebody suffer. So you're putting the animal out of your misery, not out of its misery. So if you have a dog or a cat who is sick, before you take it to the vet and have it put down, please ask your dog or your cat whether it wants to be pulled down. I say that, it's brilliant, because it works. One of my students, Judy, she had a dog, had cancer, took it to the vet, spent heaps of money on this dog, trying to get it better. Eventually the vet said, I'm sorry, but your dog is just so sick, nothing more I can do, can I have your permission to put it down? And she remembered my advice. Can I please take a couple of minutes alone with my dog? And of course the vet said, okay. So she went into the corner, a quiet little room, looked in her dog's eyes and said, do you want to die? Have you had enough? It's your decision. And if that's a dog or a cat you have known for so many years, you've loved and lived with, you ask the question, you'll know the answer. You know, in here, intuitively. And she got the message loud and clear, the dog did not want to die. So she went back to the vet and said, sorry, I'm taking it home. And that vet went ballistic. He knew she was a Buddhist. He said, you Buddhists are so cruel, so impractical. That dog is suffering. You've got no right. You call yourself compassionate, you stupid, cruel Buddhist. But, you know, she took the dog home. 6 months later, she took the dog to the vet again. It made a full recovery. The vet could not believe it. And the vet said, you Buddhists are so wise and compassionate. The dog knew. Much more than the vet. Now, whether it, you know, was going to get better or not. It's also, just like you, would you like to be put down by your wife? He's suffering. Put him down. It's not your right to kill anybody. Your right is to get the decision from your dog or your cat. Find out what your dog or cat wants. And if the dog and cat tells you it's had enough, you know it's had enough. You tell your vet, put it down, it's the dog's decision. The dog chooses, not you. You just convey the message to the doctor. And that means there's no bad karma at all. We have died many times. How come mine does not remember that? Do you remember when you were born? Can you recall coming out of your mother's womb? How many can recall coming out of your mother's womb? You can't remember it, so it didn't exist. You weren't born after all. Because that's what people say, you can't remember your past lives, therefore it didn't exist. And the answer is, you can't remember being born, therefore you didn't born, according to the same logic. How come the mind doesn't remember that? How come you don't remember when you were born? It happened, at least my mum said it happened, and I trusted her. So these things happen, but you forget when you're very young. In the Greek way of looking at things, in Plato's Republic, the last chapter on reincarnation says that when you die, you go over the river Styx, the ferryman taking you across to the Elysian fields. And the Elysian fields to this day are just nice and beautiful happiness, where you wait for a while. This is a Greek form of reincarnation. And of course, the Greeks like... Pythagoras, quoted as saying he got all of his wisdom from the Indians. Greek philosophy was not the start of Western civilization. It was just borrowed from the Indians. Basically, intellectual property theft. And after you stay there, interesting, I like this bit about Plato. He said that you have a choice where you're going to be reborn. And all the idiots choose to be reborn as rich and famous people. And the wise ones, they choose middle way. Not too rich, not too poor. Just middle way, because that's the safest, the happiest, the best. And then they go over the river Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. And then they come to reborn again. Forgetfulness, because you've got enough to worry about already. Imagine you remember all your past life. And sometimes kids do that, and it's very confusing. You know, they look at your mum and say, "Mum, you're not my real mum. I want to go to my real home." It's very confusing, which is one of the reasons why people have to forget. Later on in your life, you get some nice meditation, you can remember again, and that is really interesting. When you know, you're safe in this life, you're established, and then you can remember. So, does this mean the mind does not die? The mind doesn't die, it doesn't live, it changes, it evolves. If the self and all the senses disappear in Nibbana, then who is experiencing the bliss? Why do you need someone to experience bliss? Can't bliss just be? This is an interesting question. Book sale, waiting list, overfund. I think this is somebody's list. When you are beginning to practice, how do you shift your mind from craving sensual pleasures to craving stillness? You don't shift your mind. The mind wants pleasure. The pleasure of sensual pleasures is not much of a pleasure at all. You know, sometimes you have one sensual pleasure, you want something else afterwards. And something after, it's never ending. That is one of the reasons why there are two freedoms to be found in this world. The freedom of desire. And that's what people do when they get wealthy and powerful. You can get whatever you want, whenever you want it. If you don't like your wife, you can get a mistress because you're wealthy. One of the reasons why, your children, please advise them, if you're not married yet, there's a few young people here, my advice for choosing a partner. If you're a guy, never ever marry a beautiful girl. Marry an ugly one. And there's a lot of logic to that. If you marry a beautiful girl, a really hot chick, that means that you'll be jealous for the rest of your life. You go overseas for business, and she's such a beautiful girl. Other boys, you can see them ogling her and wanting her. And when you're away, you know, she might get seduced. And you'll always be, if you've got an ugly girl, you can go to Sri Lanka for 3 weeks, nothing to worry about. You women, never ever marry a rich guy. If he's rich, you know what? Once he's married you, he's rich, he has a mistress. That's what rich guys do. If he's poor, he can't afford a mistress. You know the saying, no money, no honey. Poor, you've got nothing to worry about. He's yours forever. So if you want a happy marriage, you girls, if you're pretty, don't go to beauty parlor, go to ugly parlor. You guys, if you've got lots of money, give it to the temple. And then you'll be happy. So all you ugly girls, you're hot. All you poor guys, you're cool. Okay. So that's shifting your perceptions. Please explain, how does chanting affect on us? Is there a supernatural power to chanting, or vibration or psychology effect? I think you follow in Canada, you follow ice hockey more than anything else. Stanley Cup, is that right?
Yeah.
Stanley Cup. So if your team is playing in the Stanley Cup final, does chanting help them? Of course it. If it's a away game, all the opposition are doing the chanting. Unless the opposition have the advantage. Chanting is like your supporters of a team. Come on, you can win. Come. Yeah. Whatever it is, chanting inspires you, encourages you. That's its power. Not inherent power, but inherent power of actually somebody supporting. Chanting when somebody is sick. You know that somebody is supporting you. Just like the team can hear all the supporters roaring for them. It uplifts them and makes their game far better. That's what chanting does. In anything supernatural, no way. Except that a lot of the chanting is Dhamma. And that Dhamma, if you understand the meaning of it, you know Pali, which many of you don't. If you know Pali, it's inspiring. You can do some pivot chants. That is incredible Dhamma you hear. Like one of my favorite chants, the Ratana Sutta. Ratana Sutta, yeah. It's all about the qualities of a stream winner. And also about being an arahat. Taking a bija, awirohi chanda. Destroy the seed, the craving. Now that chanda, desire, is not going to grow anymore. Nibbana dira yatayam padipo. You're destined for cessation, just like this lamp, that candle is destined to go out, to be extinguished. Brilliant stuff. So some of that stuff is just great Dhamma. So when I hear it, sometimes I get very inspired because I know exactly what it means. Teachings of the Buddha. Wow. But if you just do it like a parrot does chanting, you can teach a parrot to chant the Paritas. You can get a little iPod you got the Paritas on. But does that really work? Sometimes, if you really understand it, it has enormous power. This teachings, Dhamma, suttas. So that's the reason why it has power. But please excuse me, that sometimes in Sri Lanka, Thailand is the same, Burma is the same. I don't want to sort of bag any country, but I really don't like too many stupid rituals. And I couldn't believe when once I went to an all-night pirit chanting. You only do three chants, and you do it so slowly. And I'm a monk, I'm trying to be respectful, but I really had to try and force myself not to laugh. You know, when these senior terrors were just doing Namo, start of Namo Tassa, and Namo lasted about 5 minutes. You've been there, you've seen it, you've heard it. Now there may be tradition, but sometimes there are many traditions which are beautiful, keep them. There are some traditions which are way past their use-by date. Please, you know, it's embarrassing to Buddhists. Too much ritual. Too much ritual is like going into to a temple and not being able to see the Buddha through the incense smoke. That's my simile. The incense smoke of ritual. You can't see the teachings. Because the ritual tradition is way too thick. You can't see the Buddha through the incense smoke. So paritas, great if you use them wisely, but don't overdo them. Otherwise it's empty ritual, and you all know it destroys Buddhism. So get to the heart of it. You can do some chanting, keep it just as the Buddha would chant it. Just know Namo Tassa, not too long. Do lots of meditation. And then you'll be a very happy little Buddhist. Okay, that's 6 o'clock. So now's the time to have a pause as I walk upstairs to give the talk.